This is the Takeaway Weekender podcast with John Hockenberry and Irva Gunja.
I'm John Hockenberry, and you are?
Irva Gunja.
And we're going to step away from the news, I think, this week. We've got a combination of very interesting, very personal stories.
You know, John, you usually on Fridays are the one who's kind of playing the depressed card.
Playing the depressed card? What does that mean?
This Friday, I got to say, the news has definitely, totally depressed me. I am devastated by everything that's happening, so I am with you. Let's step away from it all.
I'm trying to pull us out of depression, and you're with me here.
I'm with you on
that. That's great. So I've sold you.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we begin with something that is really, really great. Tell us.
Yeah, this is a new documentary called Alive Inside. It opens in limited release in theaters in New York City this weekend. It will go into wide release a little bit later. It's something that we had hoped to air on the show this week, actually. Couldn't get to it. Just too much news happening in the world. So it'll be airing on Monday. But we wanted to give everyone a little sneak peek of what is just a fantastic documentary and a really lovely conversation.
So uplifting, so easy and accessible, and really unforgettable here. This is all about the documentary Alive Inside. And now some basic questions that seem to have no answers.
How old are you?
How old am I?
Yeah.
I'm 90 years old.
What was life like when you were a little girl?
Oh, God, I forgot so much. I've forgotten so much. I'm very sorry.
For someone who has lived nearly a century but is afflicted with advanced dementia, her life seems to be gone. Or is it?
I want to try an experiment.
What?
I want you to try and let the music take you back into your memories. To travel back into time. And then we'll stop and you can tell me where it took you. You ready?
It is not as though she never lived. Everything she did, of course, she actually did. But how to access that? Could her favorite songs constitute some kind of ledger book for her experiences, where memories can be accounted for? This is what Dan Cohen, the executive director of Music and Memory, believes he can find, has found, in Alzheimer's patients through music. He takes a pair of headphones with an iPod loaded with her favorite songs, and the memories suddenly spill forth.
Mama told us not to go to listen to him, and we would sneak off at night, bring back pictures from the dance. And I worked in Kings County 9 years. He built in Kings County. My birthday, November 20th, 19. I was in the wartime. I was working at Fort Jackson, and my son, on February the 4th, was 69. I didn't know I could talk so much.
To see this transformation visually is pretty amazing. Even to hear it is remarkable enough. It is the story told in the new documentary, Alive Inside. Michael Rosato Bennett is the filmmaker behind the documentary. Dan Cohen told us this is a marriage of simple technology and common sense that delivers major insights into the functioning of the brain.
Most people spend their day sitting around doing nothing. Half the people never get a visitor in a nursing home on average. And so in 2006, I'd hear on the radio a journalist talking about how iPods are everywhere. And I thought, well, the kids all have them. A lot of us adults do. But, gee, in a nursing home, and if I'm ever in a nursing home, will I have access to my favorite 60s music? And so I Googled iPods and nursing homes. And even though there's 16,000 nursing homes in the U.S., I couldn't find one that was providing these for people. The way it's common today is that zero there. And so I called up, I live on Long Island, I called up a nursing home near me and I said, I know music's already your number one activity. You have live music, you have a lot of people sort of providing group music, but can we see if there is any added value if we were to totally personalize the music? And they said, sure. I came in with my laptop and some iPods and it was just, you know, an instant hit.
But hit doesn't really get to what you kind of do here in this movie where you really open a door.
I would actually argue that the word hit is a perfect description
really
of what happens because, you know, that's what happened to me. I was just filming Dan for one day. I followed him almost unwittingly. It was just sort of a job, you know. So I ended up in this nursing home and looking around and seeing on every side of me these poor souls like in these wheelchairs lined up against the walls with their heads against their chest, and it just was the most terrifying image for me of how to end your life, or literally, it, to me, it literally seemed like one of the levels of Dante's Inferno, you know?
Hi, Papa.
Huh?
How you doing?
I'm all right. I'm fine.
Who am I?
Huh?
Who am I? I'm your daughter.
Daughter?
Mm-hmm. Which one?
Wait a minute.
And then when Henry was brought in, and when Dan, you know, gave Henry the music.
You want your music now? Let's try your music, okay? And then you tell me if it's too loud or not, okay?
And when he started hearing it, and when it started sort of percolating in his soul, literally, and percolating this human being out of him, you know. Me sitting there 2 feet away, I got hit. You know, there's a physical, like spiritual, electrical experience that happens when you see a human being who wakes up, who comes to life.
Mm. And the music, you know, opens this door and takes you down through this corridor of an entire life, and suddenly these memories come out. And what's it like to experience that?
Well, it's of course it's a joy to experience that. You know, we hear these numbers of there are 5.5 million people with Alzheimer's disease in the U.S. 40% of those have very advanced are in the advanced stages of that disease, and we as a society basically believe that these folks are no longer able to experience pleasure. So we give up on them. We give them these drugs that dull them even further, and nobody pays attention to them. But if we can, you know, because if you ask them, oh, here, you know, hi, Dad, I'm here, that's not going to do it. But if you put, you know, headphones on with music that has personal meaning to them, then they'll start to talk and reminisce and interact and maybe remember the name of their spouse or their grandchild that's there with them. And this impact is residual. So you take the headphones off, and it stays for the day. And then you put the headphones on the next morning, get some up, so it stays. So you can just create this ongoing level of interaction and aliveness just by feeding them this and connecting them with this sort of backdoor, bypassing the failing short-term memory, because they do have these long-term memories. That is not so much affected by the disease.
Did you expect visually this would be so vivid? You know, because this does sound, you know, without seeing the movie, like a kind of a nice charitable gesture, give right. some people iPads. But visually, this is just astounding.
There is something that I completely did not expect, you know, and I think it's really why people are reacting to this film as much as they are emotionally. And what it is these people, they've lost so much in their mind, you know. They've lost their memory. They've lost, I like to say, they've lost the capacity to lie, you know. But their capacity to love is still very profound. And so what I think happens is when you're watching these people, you're seeing something you don't often get the chance to see, you know, a completely unprotected human soul, you know. And then you're seeing that soul reacting to music, which is one of the deepest human conversations that we have. You know, we never talk about music. Think of how central music is to all spiritualities, all civilizations throughout human history. It's probably pre-language. It is probably one of the longest conversations we've been having as our species, you know? So that's one of the things that I think really affects people, is that when you see these people who I thought were gone. I thought they were, I was like the people Dan was talking about, like our society. You know, we think these people are done, that their life is over, that they have no capacity to experience pleasure, you know? And it took me a year of filming before I could actually see the life in these people.
How did you do the forensics on individual people in the sense of how did you, you know, if they can't remember the tunes that really are personal to them, that relate to their specific memories, how did you find out what the favorites were, what the playlists were that were going to work with each of these individuals?
This is probably the hardest part. So if they have family, that's great. We'll ask some questions. Gee, what did they listen to when they were young? Did they play an instrument? Were they in a chorus or a choir? And then once you have that list, you have it for the rest of their life. Hmm.
anyone can relate to this experience in this movie. Right. And that's the thing. You don't have to, it's not about dementia so much as it's about, oh, I've got that playlist.
Can I ask you that question? Like, if I ask you to close your eyes just for 1 second and go back to when you were 15 or 16 years old and think of one song that was meaningful to you back then, like really think about it, feel it in your body, and then give me the memory that comes from that
God,
thought. Come on.
There's so many. Since my dad played in a Dixieland band, there's a song called Lass's Trombone. And if I close my eyes and hear that Dixieland tune, I can see like my whole family and my dad right up there on stage. And
I just want to point out that the temperature in the room just changed when you started talking like that, because you went into a place of memory. You went into your emotional system. You went into a different part of your being. And this is the amazing thing about this interaction, and why, you know, we, Dan and I, have this dream that we can inspire young people to do this experiment. There's this huge population of elders that need that forensic work done.
Yeah. You know? I've got some Zeppelin videos, too, in my brain that I could go to, that's for sure. Well, thanks, guys.
Thank you so much. This has been really terrific.
Thank you so
Excellent.
Much.
Excellent. You got a coming-of-age book in your life, something like Catcher in the Rye?
Catcher in the Rye was one I read in high school, but I would say more coming of age for me might be the book Of Human Bondage, which I read in college.
That's a famous one. That's great.
That's great.
Definitely a figuring out your identity. For a lot of people, it was The Sun Also Rises, the Ernest Hemingway book. We had a great interview with the grandson of Ernest Hemingway, who's actually edited a brand new, curated a new edition of The Sun Also Rises. And it turns out there's some pretty interesting backstories about this very famous 20th century coming-of-age story.
This new Hemingway library edition of The Sun Also Rises really gets into that and how my grandfather wrote the book. And it was, I think he'd written many short stories, and he'd tried to write a novel before, but and it was lost at the train station in Paris.
Crazy story.
At the Gare de Lyon, must have been terribly frustrating for him. But after going to Pamplona, he really knew he had a great subject, and he went at it furiously. He knew he had to write a novel. He'd been writing so many wonderful short stories, but he needed a novel.
And, you know, in our time, it would never happen that you'd lose a whole novel, you know, because it would be on some hard drive somewhere. In many ways, that might have been the best thing that ever happened to him, having to recreate those scenes and really confront that language again to have something completely lost so that he wasn't just re-editing some version.
I think that's a really good point. We'll never really know exactly what that first novel was, but I don't think it was the masterpiece that The Sun Also Rises is. And I think he learned a tremendous amount in Paris, you know, mingling with all these other great writers and artists and luminaries. It was a great training ground for him.
Do you think he fell in love with that time and was aware of it in the way that we are so aware of it when we read this book?
It's funny because I think in some of the deleted passages that are included in this new edition, he disparages a bit the quarter and his colleagues, and yet he clearly sat at the foot of Gertrude Stein and learned from her and was greatly influenced by her. I think he was very caught up in it. I mean, he was living it. Later on in his life and works like A Movable Feast, he really goes back and reflects differently on it.
What do you hope that the reader gets from this particular edition that would be different from someone coming from The Sun Also Rises the very first time?
Well, this edition allows you to really pull back the curtain and look at the creative writing process that my grandfather went through. And it's amazing to think that this was his first novel to be published and how the problems he had writing it and how he went about writing it. And he really he threw himself into it. He wrote the first draft in 2 months. And later he said that he wrote too quickly and he had to do a lot of editing. So you can see that. You can see examples of the first draft and how different it is from the final product and all the changes that he did to finish the book and polish it and make it the way he wanted it to be.
You know, in many ways you describe the collaboration and the friendship between Ernest Hemingway, other writers of the time, Hudson, Ford, Maddox, Ford. Where do you think your grandfather stands in comparison with those two writers who were also struggling with some of the same issues of what's going on in the 20th century?
I think my grandfather is right up there. I mean, he chose as subjects in his books to deal a lot with the consequences of war, both World War I and World War II and the Spanish Civil War. War was a subject for him that was a powerful subject that he wrote about a lot. Of course, he was also a naturalist like Hudson, and he loved to write about hunting and fishing and experiencing nature. I think my grandfather is right up there with those writers, and that's part of the amazing thing about this book, I think, that it has appealed to generation after generation of people, especially young people reading it. It has a vitality and a fresh quality that it still resonates today. I think what's fascinating in the material that's included in this new edition is this unpublished foreword that he wrote for it and how serious it is, how literary and how, I mean, he's sort of depressed really about the effects of World War I and how for his generation that has devastated everyone and that they can't move beyond it. And that's what you see in this book, in The Sun Also Rises, is these broken people who can't move beyond the damages of the war. And some of the background of that is included in these discarded chapters from the beginning of the novel that Hemingway cut at the galley stage. But it's all still there. It's under the surface, as my grandfather used to like to say about his writing.
Do you think that foreword and this book speaks in many ways to the people 100 years after World War I who are wondering about this moment in time right now, that he's really speaking
today? I think it does, unfortunately, because around the world we continue to be involved in conflicts, not just America, in Afghanistan and Iraq, and we see the wars in Syria and the conflicts going on in Palestine. And I mean, the war is everywhere, and I think this book remains a very powerful reference point for seeing how damaged people are by war, whether it's physically damaged, like Jake Barnes, or whether it's someone like Bill Campbell or Brett Ashley who have been emotionally damaged. And there are thousands of people around the world who come back with post-traumatic stress disorder from war for serving their countries and have to go on and live their lives, and they do the best they can. But it is it's a phenomenon that continues.
Do you think the way this book was received and some of that part of the experience you get into in this edition constituted the happiest moments of your grandfather's life?
Well, I think he was delighted at the reception of it, and it was a success from the moment it was published. It was important to him, but in other ways, I think that he wasn't proud of the way the people act in the book. Mm. I mean, his mother wouldn't read the book because she felt it was too immoral.
Crazy, yeah, yeah.
Acts in it, but one of the interesting things I think in this new edition is it includes the original beginning of the book, which focuses on the bullfighter. And the story was originally going to be more about the bullfighter and the dissolution of a bullfighter, but that totally changed as he wrote the book. And in the end, the bullfighter becomes the character who is closest, truest to himself and his art.
What do you think he would say about this project and you? Would he say, get out of my desk. What are you doing messing around with all this?
That's a good question. You know, I never knew my grandfather. Right. He died before I was born, so I can only imagine what he would say. And I think it is true that he saved all of his manuscripts. I think he recognized that he was a great writer and that he would have a place in world literature. And by saving all of these manuscripts, he knew that they would be studied and examined and published eventually. So I hope that I think he would appreciate the care with which I've looked at these manuscripts and also the care with which I've tried to preserve his legacy, his huge legacy to America and the world.
Well, Sean Hemingway, are you a good fisherman?
I love to fish, yes, thank you.
All right, so he'd be proud of that, certainly. Sean, thanks so much.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
You're listening to the Takeaway Weekender podcast.
So, John, this next story here is all about a man who really loves his job.
Really loves his job.
And it's kind of one of the craziest jobs. So it's surprising that he loves it so much. But it's a job that he says he grew up with, is as important to him as his family is.
And if they'd let him, he'd still do it today.
That's right.
We think of this time of year as forest fire season, and indeed, in parts of the West, hot weather does make this a vulnerable time for the wilderness. There are huge wildfires right now in the states of Washington and Oregon, complicated by warmer weather and the fact that people now live in the path of the fires, where that was not the case 40 years ago, in the old Smokey the Bear days, when this U.S. Department of the Interior film was made.
This type of high-elevation fire is under study by the National Park Resources managers and researchers to monitor their effects. Prior to 1968, all lightning fires in Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks were vigorously put out. Fuels began to build up to dangerous levels.
In fact, back in 1976, when our next guest retired as a firefighter, one of the biggest fires in the country was in South Carolina, 30,000-acre blaze in Horry County that took 100 firefighters nearly a week to clear. Today, the technology for fighting forest fires has changed, and the old Smokey the Bear approach has changed completely. But the passion for saving the wilderness is still the same, and it still lives in the heart of 22-year veteran smoke jumper Jeff Davis, who guarded the wilderness of Montana during his long career.
It wasn't just a career. It ended up being a love affair. I raised a family doing it, and it's all I ever did all my whole life for 22 years.
And how do you get the call? Are you sitting around the breakfast table? What happens exactly?
Well, they'll give us a call from the jump base, and then they will, from the forest, they will put in a fire request for so many jumpers. And that's the estimated number of jumpers that it will take to control the fire. 8 men to the Salmon River or whatever, and we assemble and go. Jump in an airplane, and the whole idea of the smoke jumpers, we go in by parachute so we can get there quick and hit that fire with quick initial attack and prevent it from becoming a large one.
Now, Jeff, do you ever get dropped into a place and they said, okay, 8 men to the Salmon River, and you get down there and you and the other 7 look at each other and go, we need 80 in here?
Oh, yeah, I've had many examples of that. One of them we needed, it was on the Salmon River, a fire called a Bull Creek Fire, and that country is steep as a cow's face. It always requires an awful lot of men. Usually the fires go wild, or the jumping is pretty hairy. Long story short, there was a fire that needed at least 32 jumpers on it, and there was just myself and one other guy that stayed there for a half a month to put it out because we were the only ones in camp. By the time they got more jumpers over the fire, the winds were so ferocious they couldn't drop any of them. So me and a man named Jim Elms stayed there for a half a month till it was out.
My goodness. How did you protect yourself?
Well, it's pretty primitive. There wasn't really any sleeping. Of course, in those years, safety requirements were not in place that prevented us from working around the clock. And once we jumped a fire, we would stay on it working 24 hours a day until it was out. If that was 2-3 days, you know, we'd take cat naps on the fire line and stuff. But in that country, it was so steep, we couldn't even find a place to sleep, and it was pointless to try anyway. And the only water that we have for ourselves, potable water, is strictly for drinking. It's they drop 5 gallons per 2 men, and that's expected to last us for 3 days. Everything we have out there is expected to last us 3 days because we can't necessarily count on air supply after that.
So what lessons did you guys learn, you know, 20 years ago, 22 years ago? Because a lot of the wildfires we have today are caused by some of the fuel that built up in the way in which forests were managed really over the last couple of decades.
Absolutely. The Yellowstone Holocaust is a good example of that. Fire management policy has changed over the years, of course. And back in my time, in the 50s and 60s, 70s, the policy was to put them all out, regardless. Sometimes I'd have to race my guys to the ground before the fire went out because we knew it was going to. But we jumped every one of them that we were sent to, and we put them all out regardless. We could tell some of them were going to burn out by themselves. The Yellowstone disaster was because it was completely protected. They didn't want any fires going on in there at all. The end result of that, unfortunately, is a huge buildup of understory, timber falling down, trash, debris, and once it starts, there's no stopping it. We study fire behavior. To a certain point, you can predict exactly what a fire is going to do. But I liken it to a 500-pound gorilla. Once that fire takes over to a certain extent, it can go anywhere it wants. There's nothing that can stop it. They're called blow-ups or firestorms, and we've lost a number of guys. By the time they realize they're in trouble, they're dead.
Jeff, did anybody drop you into one of those gorillas?
Oh, I've been in several of them, yeah. One of them notably that was in California was a brush fire. We didn't jump it. We were flown in and trucked into the fire. And it was a firestorm, and there was people died on it. And they wanted us to go down in some unsafe terrain and pull some unsafe fire attack procedure, and we were too smart for that. And we said, no, we'll stay in the black. That means where it's burned. It's the only place that's safe. We're not going down there. We're not going to risk any men just for a fire. And they put some other men down there, and it blew up, and it was pretty bad.
You know, I'm thinking, Jeff, that of all the ways to go, in one of those fires has got to be about the worst.
Yeah. A lot of people wondered why those people jumped off the Twin Towers when that happened. You will do anything to avoid fire. You will jump anything, anywhere, knowing you're going to die. That's why people throw their babies out and they jump themselves with or without a net. You can't stand the heat. Your flesh is melting. You're not really even aware of that. You only have one thought in your mind, and that is to get out, get away from that, no matter what.
Now, in the development that's happened over the last few decades, do you have concern about yourself and other firefighters and smoke jumpers and, fire bosses being flown into areas where you're basically just protecting some rich person's mansion that was built somewhere where maybe there shouldn't be a house? You know what I mean?
Well, yes. Yes, sir. In more recent times, we call it interface, where it's on the real estate people that sell country that should never have been built into because it's wildfire country. It's forest. It's natural forest. People don't belong there. Back in our time, there wasn't nearly as much of that. And all the fires that we saw were out in the wilderness. That's why they called us anyway, because there was no roads, no access to it. Nowadays, unfortunately, a lot of times firefighters, whether they're smoke jumpers or hot shots or tanker crews, are going in to save structures and lives. We didn't face that situation much back in the 50s and 60s.
So are you a brave man, Jeff Davis, or are you a crazy fellow?
I'm one of them crazy parachute jumpers. All I did for a living was jump out of perfectly good airplanes and fight fires I wasn't mad at. I don't consider myself particularly brave. It just kind of goes with the territory. We react. We're well-trained, and we just respond, and then we sweat it out later.
Jeff Davis, retired smoke jumper in Silver City, New Mexico. How old are you, Jeff?
I'm 77.
All right. Well, you know, I'd feel good if I knew you were on the case, even at age 77.
Well, that's quite a compliment. I walk a little funny these days, kind of as a result of a few too many hard parachute landings, so I don't think you'd want to count on me. I'm at the point now I'll let the kids take over and do it.
Good for you. Take care.
Thank you very much.
Our last offering here on The Weekender is my favorite moment of the week, but we didn't air it, actually. It got cut out.
Yeah, this scientist, Stephen Wesslin, professor of color science,
right.
Real thing, talked to us about black being the new black.
And it's a very scientific story. During the course of the interview, I actually guessed the color of the shirt he was wearing. So listen to this, and we'll tell you at the end.
Many people think that black is the absence of light. But in fact, if you think about your black car or your black jeans, your black smartphone, any of those things, they all reflect the light falling upon them. So black isn't really the absence of light, as people may think.
What does this Vanta black have that causes it to be more black than, say, you know, a can of Krylon spray paint that I might, spray on a wall?
Yes, so most surfaces that we come across in the world reflect about 4% of the light falling upon them. So there's a limit to how black they can be. But these new substances are made out of something called nanotubules or nanotubes. And these are very, very fine hairs or straws, if you like. Think of taking a human hair and splitting it 10,000 times down its length. That's the sort of fineness we're talking about. And when you make materials out of that sort of material, they can absorb literally almost all of the light that falls upon them. In fact, it's a world record in terms of how black it is in physical terms.
Is this an expensive material? Would it be utilizable for fashion? What would you actually use this for?
I don't know the cost, but my understanding is it's very, very expensive. It's not for you or I. I guess in the distant future, it could be used for fashion. And it would be extremely unusual because, let's say someone's wearing a Spider-Man suit made out of this material. They would just look like almost like a shadow, just like a black shape.
So it would be like, reality itself is sort of cut out of...
Exactly. So like you've cut out of what you're looking at. Hmm. But the applications being thought of aren't for fashion because it's too expensive.
Right.
The sort of thing I'm looking at is taking photographs of very distant stars in the universe and try to get a cleaner, better image.
So you could precisely pinpoint what you want to look at, and all of the other light bouncing around would be absorbed by this strange stuff.
And that would enable you to look further and deeper into space. And that's the sort of applications people are thinking of.
Now, does the nanotube stuff literally capture the light, or does it just sort of trick it? Is it an optical illusion? Is it geometry that's at work here?
It's a bit of geometry and a bit of scale. So the light basically bounces around inside a network of these tubes. Eventually, it gets absorbed and turned into heat, which is actually what happens, by the way, with all of our clothes. So you might have heard people say, for example, if you wear a white T-shirt in summer, it's cooler than a black T-shirt. And you may have thought, is that an old wives' tale or is it really true?
Right.
Well, actually, it's really true. You can measure it because when things absorb light, whether they're black or dark navy, for example, something has to happen to the light, the energy. And what happens to it is that it gets converted from light into heat. And you can actually measure the temperature increase of someone wearing a black T-shirt compared to a white T-shirt, for example.
I'm guessing that you're wearing a plaid shirt.
I am, yes.
Wow. This is radio.
That's great radio.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Westland, thanks so much.
It's been a pleasure. Very nice to speak with you.
Dr. Stephen Westland is a professor of color science at the University of Leeds. That's all for The Weekender. You have a good weekend now.
Thanks. You too, John. We'll talk to you all on Monday.
This has been the Takeaway Weekender podcast. You can catch all our show's content by visiting us at thetakeaway.org. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/thetakeaway and follow us on Twitter using the handle @thetakeaway.
A lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.